Welcome to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Thanks for tuning in again this week. And if you're a new listener, welcome. We talk on the Everything Financial Radio podcast about what's going on in the economy and the markets and what it might mean for you and your money. Joining me on today's program will be Mr. Jay Taylor. Jay is the well-known host of the radio program, Turning Hard Times into Good Times. He has some terrific guests on the program. We'll be picking his brain today about what's going on in China with a new gold fix. China just announced that they will be putting together a gold pricing model in their currency. That is a big step. We'll talk about what it might mean for you and your money with Mr. Jay Taylor. And also joining me on today's podcast, Dr. Joseph T. Salerno. Dr. Salerno is the academic vice president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. We're going to get his perspective on what's going on in the economy and the markets from an Austrian perspective. I know that may not mean a lot to many of you listening to the podcast today, but he's going to be able to help you kind of connect the dots as to what's going on out there and what you might expect moving ahead. If you're not yet a subscriber to my Portfolio Watch newsletter, it is delivered for free every Monday at 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern. I talk in the newsletter each week about what's going on in the economy, give you my analysis of what's going on in the markets. And if you'd like to become a subscriber, simply visit yourportfoliowatch.com. The website again is yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Jay Taylor. You can learn more about Jay's work at jaytaylormedia.com. That's J-A-Y-T-A-Y-L-O-R media.com. He is the host of Turning Hard Times into Good Times, a radio program that airs live every day from 3 to 4 Eastern Time, and that airs at voiceamerica.com on the business channel. Jay, welcome back to the program. It's nice to have you back.
Well, it's nice to be back.
Jay, talk to the listeners. You and one on your program recently were talking about this massive accumulation of gold that China and Russia have been engaged in. Can you just expand on what's been going on for the listeners' benefit?
Yeah, I will try. Certainly, it's I think it's a really big picture story. I think it's related as much to geopolitics as anything. You know, the United States under Richard Nixon chose to detach its currency from any value. It chose to detach the dollar from gold in 1971, August 15th. I remember it very well. I'm old enough to have lived through that. I'm old enough to remember when we actually had an international gold standard. But when that happened, essentially, there was nothing that gave the dollar any intrinsic value any longer. And so shortly thereafter, Kissinger, in a series of agreements with Saudi Arabia, arranged for the dollar to be used as for international trade in oil, so that all the OPEC nations then were required to sell their oil in exchange for dollars, thus putting a bid under the dollar, making the dollar have some value. And, of course, a lot of countries weren't very happy about that, because up to that point in time, we were supposed to pay. The agreement under Bretton Woods said that for every $35, they could exchange those dollars, foreign countries could exchange those dollars for an ounce of gold. Well, when Nixon took us off that gold standard, what it did was allow the United States to print seemingly infinite amounts of money, and indeed that's what we've been doing, especially since 2008, 2009, huge amounts of money created out of nothing, which are really tickets that bid away the assets of the world. And countries that don't have that privilege are not very happy about that, especially those that are not our closest allies, such as Russia and China. Russia and China, and China especially, have been trying to get what they consider to be equal footing at the IMF and other institutions that are really the spoils of World War II that the United States and the NATO countries have dominated. But they haven't made much progress. So I think what's happened is that Russia and China have chosen to, and other countries related to their trading bloc, have decided to try to compete against the dollar the honest way, and that is by backing their own currency trading system and establishing a competing trading system and a trading currency, essentially, that is backed by gold. So China has been importing huge amounts of gold, not only the government, and the government always seems to downplay the amount that everybody thinks they've probably acquired, but they encourage citizens to buy gold. In fact, you can walk into any bank in China, I'm told, and trade your yuan or whatever currency for gold. So China has now the largest producer of gold in the world. They actually have a division of the army, of their army, that's required to go out and find as much gold as they can. I don't know exactly how they proceed to do that, but there's a division in their army that has the requirement to build up gold reserves for China. Russia now is, I understand it, is the third largest gold producer in the world. And Russia is acquiring gold also through trade. Now, you know, Russia is not a part of OPEC. Iran is not part of OPEC. And so they are not required to do the, to sell their oil for dollars. And they are now setting up their own currency and essentially banking establishment. Russia and China, Iran is part of that, and a number of other countries. I'm told by William Engdahl, who was on my show last week, that India is very much a part of this establishment too and is becoming a part of it. So you have this huge population centered in India and China with this massive amount of natural resources from Russia, and they are creating a trading bloc. Now, how do they compete against the United States? The United States, with its ability to spend unlimited amounts of money, seemingly, to build up its military, has a military capability and technology in its military that's second to none. How does China and Russia compete economically when the United States uses its military power, essentially, and its CIA and so forth, and NGOs to destabilize and change regimes in various parts of the world, and then enforce that with the military? How does China and Russia compete? I think they're doing it with currency wars, essentially. I think they're doing it by building up a solid currency that is based, in fact, on an asset, gold, whereas our system here in the West is based on liability. It's a liability system. Money is created out of debt. So debt is the raw material from which money is created, and we are creating debt much more rapidly than income. So the West is now becoming increasingly insolvent. And if you look at Russia, for example, they have virtually no debt. I think it's 16% of GDP compared to whatever we have, which is well over 100-125%. China would seem to have some issues, and I'm not really sure that I agree with William Engdahl, who's been a guest on my show, that China, I think that they have huge amounts of debt that's going to be a big problem for them. But if that part of the world is really setting up their own system based on an asset-based money, and the West has a monetary system that is based on nothing except the military might to force countries to trade in, to use the dollar for trade, well, increasingly I think we're seeing a lot of countries that this has been forced on are starting to rebel in one way or another around the edges. I think even some of our closer European allies are really starting to become very unhappy about this. And then we force them to engage in sanctions that hurt their trading ability with countries like Russia and China and so forth. So I think that's what's happening with Russia and China buying huge amounts of gold. And then I think it's very important to note, and we'll see how this plays out, but the Shanghai Gold Exchange just recently has been put into operation. And this is a fully 100%, as I understand it, bullion trading exchange, whereas the LBMA and the COMEX in the West are really fraudulent exchanges, their paper exchanges, in which people buy contracts that are supposedly backed by gold, but most people don't really want to take possession of the gold, so they're happy just to trade these virtual contracts.
I'm going to have to stop right there, but I would like to talk more about the Shanghai Exchange in the next segment. I'm running out of time here.
Sure.
But let's pick it up again in the next segment. I want to talk to Jay about the Shanghai Exchange and what that ultimately means maybe for the standard of living of Americans. Our guest today, Jay Taylor, his website, jaytaylormedia.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Well, you're listening to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. I'm Dennis Tubergen, your host. Certainly hope you're enjoying my conversation with Mr. Jay Taylor and hope you're getting something you can use. I'll get right back to that conversation now. I am pleased today to be chatting with Mr. Jay Taylor, who was on the program several months ago. Jay's website is jaytaylormedia.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. I would also encourage you to listen to his radio program, Turning Hard Times into Good Times. It airs live 3 to 4 Eastern time every day on Voice of America. That's voiceamerica.com. And Jay, in the last segment, you started to talk about this Shanghai Exchange where China's really got their own gold market, gold priced in yuan. And you talked about the fact that on the Shanghai Exchange that there actually will be a requirement to have these contracts backed by gold, unlike the London market and the COMEX market. So does this mean China now has taken the first step to tying their currency to gold? And will we see a return to the gold standard? What's your view?
I sort of think that it might not be just China, but this trading bloc that will be using gold as a means to support confidence in their currency. So, you know, a little bit perhaps like the Bretton Woods situation was. Whether China really goes on a gold standard where people can walk in and churn their yuan in exchange for gold and take gold out, I don't know if it's going to go there, but I think at least at this stage that those countries are seeing that as a way to compete against the West, to compete with monetarily against a Western world that is destroying its currency at a very rapid rate. So as I was saying, the Shanghai Gold Exchange requires, it's a completely 100% bullion exchange, as I understand it. There's no paper exchanges. There's no paper contracts that are not backed by gold. So it's my understanding that in order to sell gold at the Shanghai Exchange, you have to deliver the gold bullion to the exchange before you can sell it. This is in complete opposite of what we have in the West, whereas people might think they own gold when they buy some GLD or some contract on the exchange, and there is no gold in the coffers anywhere to back that. But people thinking they own gold, they're fine with that, until, of course, someday when they want to take the gold and it's not there. And so I think there's a realization that, you know, in the West that things aren't what they seem to be. So it could be that China is heading in that direction, and the other countries that are trading with China and Russia and Iran. But whether they're going exactly into a gold standard, I don't know. And let me just say that I don't necessarily long-term trust the Chinese or the Russians or anyone else not to do the same thing that we did. We were on a gold standard. The dollar was as good as gold until Nixon took us off for political reasons in the short term that seemed to be advantageous to certain interests within the United States, if not the common person.
So, Jay, who... it seems to me, and I am just learning about this myself, but it seems to me that if I have the option to trade in gold bullion or in paper that is at least highly leveraged at best to physical gold, that the Chinese are going to, at the very least, soon dominate the gold market. Would you agree?
Well, that seems to be the potential, and I think that's why, in terms of the dollar, you know, what is an ounce of gold? I mean, what is a dollar? You can say, you know, a barrel of oil is a barrel of oil, an ounce of gold is an ounce of gold. So I think that we're starting to see some weakness in dollars, and I had Jim Rickards on my show recently, and he was talking about the need, actually, for the United States dollar to get weaker now to try to keep the global economy intact because, you know, China has their yuan attached to the dollar. So the dollar needs to be weakened. I mean, the Chinese tried to unilaterally reduce their currency relative to the dollar, and it caused havoc in the international market. So what he's suggesting is there's an agreement between the nations that the dollar needs to come down now relative so that the Chinese yuan can come down because of its importance in the global economy, the number two largest economies in the world. So that may be what's happening, but if the dollar starts to go down and in a meaningful way, and I think technically it looks to me like it is breaking down, then we're going to see some real increases in the gold price. I would see that maneuver, though, as a way to try to hold on the part of the West, to try to hold on to the paper standard they have. But sooner or later, all this money that's being created out of nothing is leading us into insolvency, you know, increasing insolvency in the West. And so I think things are going to come down, unfortunately. And I think the best thing people can do is to exchange, do what the Chinese are doing, what the Russians are doing, exchange their dollars, which are based on nothing, and buy gold bullion and silver bullion, too, I would suggest.
Well, obviously, Jim Rickards is a very credible guy. And, Jay, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. I mean, if this happens and there is an agreement to devalue the dollar and the dollar is devalued, that's going to mean that standard of livings here are going to have to drop.
Absolutely. They will drop. They are dropping. They have been dropping, and that's the problem. And that's why we have, you know, so-called fringe candidates grabbing so much a part of the vote in the presidential primaries. People don't necessarily understand what I'm talking about. But they know that something has gone terribly wrong, and they know that somehow the unemployment rate that the government pretends is the unemployment rate is a lot of baloney. They understand that they are not able to live with the same standard that they have been living. But this, unfortunately, is going to get much, much worse, I'm afraid. I hope and pray not, but I think the handwriting is on the wall. The United States, the Western world, has been living beyond its means for so long, and when we went off the gold standard in 1971, it enabled the bankers to redistribute wealth because they are the ones that create the money, the tickets, if you will, the demand tickets for the goods and services of this world, and put it and line their own pockets. And the redistribution of wealth will not be helped by Mr. Sanders' ideas of taxing the rich, because the rich will find a way to print even more money and put it in their pockets. No, what we need is to go back to an honest monetary system like the Chinese and Russians are doing, or something similar to that, or some basis that holds down the creation of money to some finite level so that you can't have the people that print the money stealing the wealth, which is really what's happening. It's an unjust story, but we're going to have some great pain. And the best thing to do, though, I think, is to exchange those dollars for something that's real, for gold and silver and other tangibles as well.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Jay Taylor. He is the host of Turning Hard Times into Good Times. If you're just joining us, the program airs on Voice of America's business channel every day from 3 to 4 Eastern. It's a live program, and you can check it out at voiceamerica.com. Jay's website is jaytaylormedia.com. I'd encourage you to check that out as well. And, Jay, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Monday, Monday, Monday. Always Sunday. In the rich man's world.
Well, you are listening to the Everything Financial Radio podcast, and I am going to get right to my conversation with Dr. Joseph T. Salerno. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Joseph Salerno. Dr. Salerno received his PhD in economics from Rutgers University. He's professor of economics in the Finance and Graduate Economics Department in the Lubin School of Business of Pace University in New York. He's the editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics and the academic vice president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He's the co-editor of the recently released book, The Rothbard Reader, that is published by the Mises Institute. And Dr. Salerno, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk to start with, Joseph, about your book, The Rothbard Reader. What was your motivation to do the book?
Well, Murray Rothbard was really the person who helped revive, or was the main, mainly responsible for reviving Austrian economics when it was, really had pretty much died out by the late 1950s. So in the early 1960s, he wrote a number of great works, a treatise called Man, Economy, and State, a great book explaining America's Great Depression. He wrote a book on money. So in those early years, his work came out and influenced many, many people, including myself, many young graduate students, undergraduates, and so on. Credit for the rebirth of Austrian economics is usually given to the fact that Friedrich Hayek won the Nobel Prize, a famous Austrian economist. He won the Nobel Prize in 1974, and then we also had a big conference at South Royalton in Vermont, where all Austrians came together, also in 1974. So the Austrian revival or rebirth is usually attributed to that. So to make a long story short, why did 40 to 50 people show up at this conference, in 1974, when the call went out for Austrian economics? Well, people had familiarized themselves, this is what is forgotten, and we want to bring this back in the book, with Murray Rothbard's works. And so he is the man responsible for bringing back Austrian economics and really popularizing it then with his writings in the 80s and 90s, early 90s. So that was the motivation behind putting together the reader. But one other motivation was just to show the wide breadth of his knowledge. We have here not only his more scholarly work, for example, on social sciences and basic economics and business cycles and so on, which we carefully chose to make sure that they were suitable for a popular audience to read. But we also have his movie reviews. He had a wide interest in cultural affairs and wrote widely on them. And he's a very entertaining writer. So we wanted to give you a taste of his breadth of knowledge. It's not a very long book. It's under 300 pages. And as I said, it's written for the very interested layperson who wants to learn more about Murray Rothbard's thoughts, his political philosophy, and his thinking on culture.
Well, Joseph, let me go back to something you started saying, that Murray Rothbard really was responsible for reintroducing Austrian economics. And we have a number of folks in our audience that are hardworking folks. They're professionals. They're putting away money in 401ks and IRAs, and they probably don't even know what Austrian economics is. So maybe you could give them a definition.
Yeah, well, it's hard to define it in a few words, but basically, Austrian economics, as opposed to all other schools of economics today, starts its reasoning with the actions of individuals, with the actions of consumers, producers, entrepreneurs, and then it builds up its explanations about why things may go wrong with the economy and why the capitalist economy does so well on its own. It builds up that reasoning from analyzing these actions and interactions of individual human beings, all who have their own ends in mind when they're acting in the economic arena. So to put it very shortly, Austrian economics is focused on the individual and his or her attempts to satisfy their wants. Okay, so that's how we would define it. And then it builds up its reasoning from that point.
So explain, if you would, you mentioned the Depression earlier, and many of our listeners are familiar with the response to the Depression, in that gold was confiscated, money was printed, maybe not unlike what we're seeing today. Explain what an Austrian response to that situation would have been.
Well, the Austrian response is twofold. One, there was a huge increase in the money supply during the 1920s. Now, that was hidden, the inflation from that increase in money supply was hidden from the public's view because the capitalist economy in the 1920s, the U.S. economy, had become so much more productive. Refrigeration was introduced, radios were introduced, cars were mass-produced, so we had tremendous increase in the supply of goods and services in the economy, and that tended to drive prices down. So what the Fed did was, in response, was try to stabilize prices by increasing the money supply. So prices didn't change much during the 1920s. When, if the Fed had not interfered, they should have fallen a great deal each year, but they did not. So the new money came into the system, distorted the interest rates because it came in through the banking system. The bank system loaned it out. Artificially lowered interest rates and caused entrepreneurs to begin to make bad investments. And so we had a run-up in real estate prices, much as we did in the 2000s, a run-up in the stock market. So the inflation eventually led to a bust. Most mainstream economists at the time were claiming during the 1920s that since prices were stable, we were going to have perpetual prosperity. That was the phrase, that we would never have another depression. It was only the Austrian economists who were looking at what was going on in the U.S., Hayek and Ludwig von Mises, who said there's going to be a big crash coming. There's a tremendous amount of new money in the system that has distorted interest rates and caused entrepreneurs and other business people to make the wrong decisions, to invest in capital goods that were not sustainable, that people would not buy the products from. So the Austrians would have said, look, let the capitalist economy give it its head and allow it to increase output and allow prices to fall. Don't interfere with the natural fall in prices. Because remember, costs were falling too because of the great technological innovations in the 20s. And then the second part of the answer is that once we did have the recession, it didn't need to turn into an 11-year depression. It would have lasted, you know, a year or two. But once again, first President Hoover and then FDR interfered and tried to keep wages up at the same time that prices were falling. They also tried to keep the prices of agricultural products up. They interfered with the price mechanism, and they did not allow wages and prices to adjust downward as banks collapsed, as investments were liquidated, and so on. So it was a second attempt, again, in the 30s, to stop prices from falling, stop what they feared would be deflation from occurring that caused the length of the Great Depression.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes left in this segment. When you were talking about trying to keep wages up, I'm thinking of what we hear now in the current political cycle with the $15 minimum wage move. So are we seeing a lot of similarities? And we can even pick it up in the next segment if need be.
Yeah, we certainly are. Any time you raise any price above the level at which supply and demand is equal, you're going to find that you have an excess supply of that product. In this case, you have an excess supply of labor, that not all labor will be hired who wants to work at $15 an hour. So to make a long story short, that excess supply of labor is simply another word for unemployment.
Well, we're going to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Dr. Joseph T. Salerno. He is the co-editor of the book, The Rothbard Reader, published by the Mises Institute. And we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Salerno when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Let me remind you before I get back to my conversation with Dr. Joseph T. Salerno that if you would like to go back and listen to any interviews that I've done on the Everything Financial radio program and podcast over the past few years, you can visit the website everythingfinancialradio.com, and all those conversations and interviews are archived there for your listening. I'm chatting today on the Everything Financial radio program with Dr. Joseph T. Salerno. If you're just joining us, he is the co-editor of the book, The Rothbard Reader. And we're chatting with him a bit about the Austrian economics approach. And in the last segment, Joseph, we were talking about the fact that that there are some similarities between today and maybe the monetary response around the time of the Great Depression. We've had the Federal Reserve since the financial crisis that really has been engaging, not of late, but certainly they've printed a lot of money. What, in your view, from the Austrian perspective, is going to be the end result of the monetary response of the Fed since the financial crisis?
Well, I think one thing that's going to happen is that you're eventually going to see the dollar fall in value as more and more money is printed, and because we keep, you know, the previous quantitative easing programs where new money was printed. They've all failed. They failed to stimulate the economy. Our unemployment rate is back down to 5%, but there's been 2 million people that have left the labor force, so-called discouraged workers. In any case, they realize that this hasn't worked, but it seems to me that they think more of the same is what is needed. So they're going to poison the patient. Eventually, and this is they want to do this, they're going to start an inflation of consumer prices, right? They have an inflation target. It's supposed to be 2%. We haven't yet hit it. They're going to keep pouring money into the system until consumer prices begin to rise. But all the while, we see housing prices going up. Many markets are overheated. We had commodity prices booming. Now they've hit somewhat of a bust because of China's recession. But we see prices of many particular goods going up. So they're creating bubbles, financial bubbles, real estate bubbles again. And even if consumer prices don't reflect this, eventually those bubbles are going to burst. And then what's going to happen? And this is what I fear. Are they going to nationalize the banking system? Are they going to conduct mass bailouts going beyond financial institutions? So the economy's on the precipice of a big bust. And I see that coming in the next year or two. People are just not borrowing money and making sound investments. They're making these speculative investments.
Well, Joseph, when you go back and look at 1933, I believe it was, in the Depression, when President Roosevelt bought back, I won't use the word confiscate, although that's really what it was, the gold of American citizens. That was, in a sense, nationalizing a resource. You said nationalizing the banking system could be a possibility. What other possibilities might exist in your view?
That's a great question. I want to just mention that the banking system, in some sense, is already nationalized. It's already an arm of the government. They have deposit insurance, so there's an incentive to make loans that are high risk, high return, and because they know they're going to get bailed out. Even though there's a lot of talk about too big to fail being repealed, that's certainly not the case at this point. They haven't done anything to change the incentives that would change bank behavior. So we're getting the same type of behavior from the banks. Other things that could, and I thought this would happen a number of years ago, I thought eventually consumer prices would start to rise very rapidly and we would still be in a recession. Now, if that happens, I foresee the politicians once again putting on wage and price controls. So down the road, if they actually do succeed in engendering an increase in prices, in inflation, okay, because they're so afraid of deflation, they'd rather have an inflation. And that catches on and people begin to spend money at a more rapid pace. I think what you're going to see is wage and price controls coming in where they set legal limits on what wages can be paid and what prices can be charged. And that would be disastrous because that's basically socialization of the entire economy.
Well, and Joseph, there's certainly a number of times historically that wage and price controls have been tried. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe most recently price controls were attempted in Venezuela, and the end result is there's nothing left on the shelves to buy. Has there ever been an instance when wage and price controls have worked?
No, not that I know of, and not that any economist who's reputable would say. Could point to. They couldn't point to an instance where wage and price controls worked. So they never work, but politicians always resort to them. Because in the short run, people are so frustrated by inflation, by prices being higher than the day before, that they're willing to turn to any sort of a solution. And the politicians are right there to feed them this deadly solution.
So, Joseph, in your view, do you see the U.S. dollar as being in a bubble as well? Certainly, it's reports last year that China dumped some U.S. debt. There's a lot of rumblings going on now in the news as to, will the U.S. dollar, will the petrodollar be retained, or will there be an alternative? The renminbi now is being added as a reserve currency. It seems like we're on the verge of a big currency shakeup here. What's your take?
My take is that the U.S. is going to continue to try to drive the value of the dollar down. as another avenue of pumping up the economy, that is making our exports cheaper and our imports more expensive. So our consumers will be hurt, but us, the export firms will, be stimulated, and that will increase the numbers that they look at, which is GDP. All they care about is more production. Whether or not it's the right production, it's whether or not it's the goods that people really want to purchase is another story. They're not interested in that. So a cheap dollar is, at least it seems to me right now, in the interests of the policymakers at the Fed and in the U.S. government itself. So, yes, we are in a bubble. And, yes, at some point, China's having its own problems right now. But you could see a dumping of U.S. securities and therefore dollars and a decline in the value of the dollar, a catastrophic decline. I'm not saying that that's going to occur with any certainty, but it certainly looks like trends are heading in that direction.
Talk to the listeners, Dr. Salerno, about the Austrian view of money. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, every currency in the world today is a fiat currency. There's no backing by any tangible asset of any kind. So what's the end game here, and what would be the Austrian view of this?
Well, you're absolutely right. Every currency in the world is a fiat currency. It's not backed by any market-produced commodity. It's important that currencies be rooted in a market commodity like gold or silver, because that is the anchor that prevents the easy counterfeiting, if you will, of new money. But to get back to the point that you were just making, I think the one way the Austrians would approach it: look, we can't trust the government at this point to restore a gold standard. Even if they were willing to, in some sense, it would be undermined by Federal Reserve policy. So I think there's a two-pronged attack. Number one, I think what has to happen is that there has to be what's called competition in currency. That is, politicians have to remove all of the taxes, capital gains taxes, sales taxes, excise taxes on gold and silver, and on the holding of foreign currencies, which can be taxed. Allow American banks to offer accounts, deposits to their customers in the form of euros and yen and so on. So allow people to choose those currencies, whether they be gold and silver or foreign currency, which they feel most secure with, which they feel will hold the value the best. In that case, that will provide competition for the Fed. So the Fed, a depreciating dollar, people will start to get rid of it. So the Fed, that would put restraints on their inflationary propensity. And then secondly, I would like to see the Fed abolished. I think it's unconstitutional. And I think what should happen is that whether we have a fiat currency or not, as an interim step back to a sound money, the Fed should be folded into the Treasury. I mean, the Fed is right now just a bunch of unaccountable, really out-of-control bureaucrats who are using these terribly fallacious doctrines of Keynesianism and of monetarism to try to run monetary policy for hundreds of millions of people in the U.S. And that's not going to work. It never has worked. And they've gotten us into a number of huge depressions and with our latest financial crisis.
And, Dr. Salerno, we have a minute left. Do you see any, and you're preaching to the choir here, I agree with that completely, do you see that as being even remotely possible moving ahead?
Yeah, I actually do. I mean, I think as not the whole thing and not all at once, but I do see them loosening restraint on using alternatives to the dollar for currency. I do see if the dollar begins to depreciate that that's something that can pass through Congress, because that's populist legislation. That's something that Ron Paul pushed for, competition in currency. I see that there are sympathetic ears in Congress for that. And also to put some sort of a restraint on the Fed, to have some sort of congressional oversight. The Fed right now sets its own budget because it can simply print money.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Dr. Joseph T. Salerno. He is the co-editor of the book, The Rothbard Reader, published by the Mises Institute. And Dr. Salerno, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, that concludes the Everything Financial Radio podcast this week. Certainly hope you got something you can use. Joining me on next week's program will be Dr. A. Gary Schilling. Dr. Schilling is a longtime Forbes columnist, also a Forbes contributor, is Mr. John Tamney, and John will be joining me on next week's podcast as well. Talk to you then.